I was inspired by the people of this congregation last week for having the courage to come to church, driving past the anti-abortion protesters who lined our front walk. For those of you who were not here, a couple of dozen people stood in front of our church holding up 12 large signboards with pictures of grossly deformed and aborted fetuses. Last week's sermon dealt with the issue of abortion. I explained my conviction that there are good, sincere people of faith on both sides of the abortion debate. I do not like abortion. My prayer is that every woman with a crisis pregnancy will consult her family, her physician, and her faith community before she makes a decision. But like many people of faith, after countless hours of agonizing prayer, I have come to the conclusion that as a matter of religious freedom, the final decision should be prayerfully made between a woman and God. It's not up to me, nor Operation Save America, nor any other political or religious group to impose its religious views on others. I also told you last week that I respect people on both sides of this issue, and I do. For those who believe with heart and soul that human life begins at conception, that from the very beginning a fertilized egg constitutes a viable human being, I respect them for acting on their convictions, and I support their right to express their views. But I must tell you that I feel a sense of disgust and even anger toward those who would stand in front of a house of worship on a Sunday morning and force young children to look at pictures that I can only describe as obscene. I respect their conviction, but I detest their methods. This week, I planned on delivering my second sermon on the subject of bioethics, this time dealing with the subject of genetic engineering. But as the images from last week's service lingered in my mind, and as events unfolded in Wichita throughout the past week, and as so many of you conveyed to me your anger at those who lined the street in front of our church, it became clear that I should delay the sermon on genetic engineering for 1 week. As a friend in the ministry once told me, it doesn't matter how far ahead you plan your sermons. When the train runs over the school bus, your sermon sort of writes itself. Well, when those protesters stood in front of the church with their signs, for us, the train ran over the school bus. This situation has been thrust upon the people of Wichita, and if we can't apply the gospel to the problems we face in the real world, then we devalue the gospel. I'm not going to preach on abortion. I did that last week, and you know how I feel on the subject. There are written, typed copies of my sermon in the office, if any of you want them, who weren't here last week, so you can see that I have a very detailed but nuanced view on this subject. But I do want to say a few words about my involvement with this situation in Wichita over the past week. After the obscene display in front of our church, I was proud to have my name, along with many concerned citizens, including 37 ministers from Kansas Religious Leaders for Choice, placed in a Wichita Eagle ad. The ad explained in the most respectful language what we believe is the faithful, prayerful conviction that there are good people of faith on both sides of the abortion debate. Typical of the Eagle's coverage this week, our ad was buried in a little red section of the paper somewhere next to Bonnie Bing. I decided to stay away from the protests. Carrying signs and arguing with people who have already made up their minds just isn't my style. And I was concerned about the bitterness of the rhetoric emanating from both sides. Then as the week went along, I became extremely disappointed with the press coverage. The Eagle wrote that pro-choice factions shouted at people who were praying, made denigrating remarks to Catholic women as they prayed the rosary. The Eagle quoted somebody who said Mary, Jesus' mother, should have had an abortion. That was one of the most offensive things I've ever heard. But I knew enough of the pro-choice protesters who were down there to know the paper was sensationalizing the issue. Ignore the 50 people who are respectfully expressing their views and quote the one lunatic shouting obscenities. I called my friends. at Kansas Religious Leaders for Choice and expressed my concern that radical elements on both sides were taking over the debate. I believed then, and I still believe now, that it's important for the public to know that this is not a battle between the Christians and the heathens. In fact, a majority of religious Americans believe decisions regarding abortion rest with the woman. The truth is, if you poll the radical element of the pro-life movement, the types of people who would hold horrendous pictures in front of a church as it worships, you'll see that the abortion issue is simply the front issue for a broad political agenda whose victims are gays and women and anybody else who does not bow before their narrow view of the Christian faith. One of the main reasons I entered the ministry is because I believe the religious right is taking over the church. It's important for other voices to be heard, and I respect their right to their convictions, but I think it's vitally important for other Christian voices to be heard. We agreed to go together at 5 o'clock Friday morning, when the press was first arriving, and make an attempt to have our prayerful and respectful views heard before everybody started shouting. Lee and I arose at 4 o'clock in the morning, met with ministers from Kansas Religious Leaders for Choice, and went together to the clinic. But even before the press arrived, pro-choice clergy from outside the state took over the process, explaining how to shout together in order to drown out the pro-life protesters and encouraging the more militant pro-choice protesters who were arriving on the scene to be out front and noisy. Lee and I went home, dejected. Lee said she wished we could get together about 10,000 Wichitans from both sides of the debate and surround all the protesters with signs that simply said, "Go home." Today, after a week of seeing the hatred from so many people ratcheted up to frightening levels, I'm going to speak on tolerance, because tolerance is a subject that has kept me tossing and turning most nights this week. Before I move on, I want to make one thing perfectly clear, especially to those of you who were not here to hear last week's sermon. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people who call themselves pro-life are decent, loving, and committed men and women. There are many such people in this congregation. I will support with my every breath their right to act on their convictions. I have more friends and family that fall into this pro-life category than I can count, and I'm thankful for every one of them. If you are one of these people, a person who has come to the prayerful conclusion that human life begins at conception and should be protected by the laws of the United States government, please know that I am sincere when I tell you I respect your right to your beliefs. My words today are not aimed at you. In fact, I'm certain that the pro-life people of this congregation who witnessed last week's spectacle are just as offended by what transpired in front of our church as I am. Here is the question that has plagued so many of us over the past week. How can we be tolerant of the intolerant? Congregationalists tend to be extremely tolerant folks. I mean, we sort of have this philosophy that if two people agree on everything, then one of them's not really necessary. Think about it. But I've never before wrestled with this question of tolerance like I have over the past week as I lay awake at night thinking about the children of this church arriving here for worship and being subjected to something that I feel is just plain disgusting. I don't know how a child could process those pictures. Those images are bound to leave scars. The local television stations would not show those pictures on TV because they thought they might be harmful to young and sensitive viewers. But our children were given no choice. I will say that Lee and I and Kathy called as many people as we could who were not here last week that we knew had young children and asked them to stay away this morning out of fear that they might be subjected to that once again. For all the causes I believe in, And for all the convictions I have in this life, I can honestly tell you there is nothing, nothing that could ever possess me to inflict those types of scars on the children of people with whom I disagree. How can we be tolerant of the intolerant? It's not an easy question, and it certainly has no easy answer. There's one thing I know for sure. The way this world tends to work, when good people are confronted with evil, there's a tendency for the good people to start using evil tactics themselves. It's the way of the world. If evil country A drops a bomb on righteous country B, then righteous country B has little choice but to drop a bigger bomb on evil country A. The situation proliferates through a series of escalating attacks, and pretty soon you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. There's a universal law we tend to ignore. If evil battles evil, evil wins. If hatred battles hatred, only hatred can win. Love has no chance unless somebody is willing to bring love into the fray. And that, as nearly as I can tell, is the amazing wisdom of Jesus of Nazareth. All that turn the other cheek and go the extra mile stuff wasn't just some abstract philosophy of a good-natured dreamer. It was the eternally true wisdom of the one we call the Son of God. Now let's talk a little about the wisdom of Jesus. The battle cry of Operation Save America for their protests in Wichita has been, Jesus is the standard. You see it printed on their shirts. That's the name of their website, Jesus is the standard. And on their website, beneath the words, Jesus is the standard, it says, bloodshed follows bloodshed. Violence follows violence. I can honestly tell you, those are not the words of Jesus. That is not the wisdom of Jesus. As you heard in the words John Conley read from the lectern this morning, that is in fact the opposite of the message Jesus brought into the world. The message that has been conveyed to me and to other local faith leaders who do not insist their congregations stand against the right of a woman to make this choice is that we will one day face the judgment of God for leading our congregations down a false path. I have been repeatedly told that as a faith leader, it is my absolute and unequivocal duty to tell people how they should think about abortion, and for that matter, how they should think about every moral question. My response has been that I do not believe it is my responsibility, or for that matter, my right, to tell people how they should think about anything. I've explained that I view the whole purpose of my ministry as pointing people toward a relationship with God, asking people to bring God into their decision-making process, hoping every person who faces any sort of moral crisis makes his or her decision on bended knee before our loving God. And I've been told that is not nearly enough. In fact, I have received the message repeatedly that I am going to the worst part of hell for trusting you to make your own moral decisions. It's all about judgment. I can safely say that in the name of the one who said, "Judge not, lest ye be judged," I have been judged more in the past weeks than I have in my entire life. How can this be? How can it be that in the name of the one who ate with sinners, was accused of eating and drinking to excess, associated with eunuchs and tax collectors, and even dined with unholy and unclean people from outside the faith, how is it that his name is invoked in these harsh judgments? Is Jesus the standard? Well, Albert Schweitzer made the observation that every generation goes off in search of Jesus, and every generation returns from that journey with a guy that looks just like them. In our splintered society, I think it's safe to apply Schweitzer's wisdom to the various contemporary groups of Christians. We've all searched for an accurate portrait of Jesus, but the pictures we've hung on our walls aren't pictures at all. They're mirrors. Those who stand in front of churches with obscene pictures are extremely angry, and it's no surprise that their picture of Jesus is a picture of a guy who is also very angry. When those out-of-town protesters confronted me in Fellowship Hall following last week's service, I was told that even though I personally detest abortion, because I trust each of you to make your own decisions regarding abortion, I have a middle-of-the-road approach to the faith. They said, quote, Jesus said in anger, because you are lukewarm, I will spit you out of my mouth. Did Jesus ever say this? Well, that depends on who you ask. You won't find any such words attributed to Jesus in any of the four Gospels. But those words can be found in the book of Revelation. John of Patmos, well over a half century after the death of Jesus, encounters what he believes is the risen Christ in a vision, and it is that Jesus who says those words. In his vision, Jesus is described as having head and hair as white as snow, feet like burnished bronze, eyes like flames of fire, and a two-edged sword in his mouth. And frankly, when the more zealous anti-abortion protesters say Jesus is the standard, that is the Jesus they are talking about. That is the Jesus they are seeing in their mirrors. They certainly aren't referring to the Jesus who delivered the Sermon on the Mount and told parable after parable about how to enter the kingdom of heaven through love of God and love of neighbor. As a good friend of mine observed, those obsessed with the Jesus of the second coming are people who can't stand the Jesus that was here the first time. It's like they're saying, oh, sure, Jesus was all about love, compassion, and forgiveness when he was here before, but just wait till you see him next time. Next time, he'll be filled with righteous indignation and overflowing with vengeful hatred. In fact, they seem to say next time he'll be just the opposite of the person we call Jesus of Nazareth. Next time, they seem to say, he'll be filled with righteous hatred, just like us. It's an old argument. What is the inherent nature of God? If you were to ask many of the more ruthless demonstrators that question, the answer would be that the primary attribute of God is righteousness. And that's not a new answer. The prevailing wisdom at the time of Jesus was that God is a righteous God, which is why traditional wisdom, such as an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, became encoded in biblical law. Why wasn't Jesus viewed as the Messiah widely? He had, they figure, at most 120 followers out of the tens of thousands of people who heard him. Why wasn't he widely viewed as the Messiah? Because he didn't look and act like that figure John of Patmos describes in Revelation. The Messiah was supposed to be a great military leader who would rise up and establish God's righteousness through his mighty sword. Jesus didn't fit the description. But if we are to really believe that Jesus was indeed the Messiah, the incarnation, the human expression of God's nature in space and time, what does that say about God's nature? Could it be that God, the creator, sustainer, and redeemer of all creation, reigns not with a righteous and terrifying purity, but with love? Could it be that God holds the universe together not with threats of judgment, but with compassion? Could we have a God who actually loves us through every stupid mistake, who forgives our failures and shortcomings and asks only that we try to reflect a little of that perfect love through our own lives? Well, we've got three choices. We can believe that Jesus is, in some mysterious sense, truly the Son of God and an accurate reflection of God's nature. We can dismiss the idea of Jesus being the Son of God, a reflection of God. Or we can reinvent Jesus as the bellicose, self-righteous warrior that people were expecting in the first place. I choose option number one. Jesus really is an accurate reflection of God's nature. I hope we all choose that option And that means we've got our work cut out for us, because we need to get about the business of loving some people who anger us. We've got to set aside our own self-righteousness and be accepting of those with whom we simply disagree. That means, as difficult as it is, there are times when we simply must turn the other cheek. And let's be honest, that's not the answer that comes naturally to us. Consider again the people who would stand in front of a house of worship with those pictures. We want to confront those people with their pictorial obscenities. We want to go to their churches and do something they would find offensive. I don't know, maybe we could tell them we've got a great new youth minister who would like to speak to their youth group and send over Bucky Walters. I've been thinking about this a lot, you can tell. More seriously, maybe we dream of standing in front of their churches with graphic pictures of the tens of thousands of women who died in botched abortions prior to Roe v. Wade. That would shock them. That would really terrorize their children. That would really show them what? That we can be hateful too? That we don't care for their children any more than they care for ours? As hard as it is, we have to be tolerant of the intolerant. Should people have a right to protest abortion? Absolutely. In fact, I was distressed to see so many of the pro-choice faction shouting at the marchers in front of the local clinic. This is America. People have a right to peacefully assemble. People have a right to protest laws they think are wrong. And I honestly respect those who are willing to live out their convictions. If people are so upset about our abortion laws, if they're willing to drive all the way from California or Florida or New York to peacefully protest those laws in 105 degree heat, well, my goodness, let's give them some ice water. I'll go farther with my acceptance than many of you would. Do these people have a right to come to our church on Sunday morning and stand along the street saying they believe the message being proclaimed within our church is wrong? Yes. I believe they have that right. In fact, as long as they're acting out of the convictions they have written on their hearts, I believe they should have the right to stand out there and hold signs that say the minister of this church is proclaiming unchristian things from the pulpit. Obviously, I would think they are wrong, and I would never do that in front of anybody else's house of worship, but as long as they don't interrupt our worship service, I believe that should be their right. But do they have the right to hold up pictures that terrorize the children who come to this church? Do they have the right to move beyond all boundaries of decency and good taste in an attempt to traumatize our youth? Evidently, the courts have ruled that they do indeed have that right. But I tell you this, all the respect I have for the good, compassionate people of faith who call themselves pro-life, sometimes gets buried deeply beneath the bitterness I feel toward those who would stoop to that level of evil. But we have to find the courage and grace to walk through this life the way Jesus taught. Somehow, some way, we have to be tolerant, tolerant of the intolerant. And not only that, we have to love them while doing everything we can to protect our children from their hatred. We have to reach down inside ourselves and find a love that is deeper than our judgments, a love that is stronger than our emotions, a love even more lasting than our anger. We have to be Christians.